When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm David Kern.
And I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Tim McIntosh.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader. We are here to discuss Ernest Hemingway's novel, The Sun Also Rises. We're going to discuss the final chapters. And I have a question for you, Tim McIntosh, as we get started.
Yes, I'm ready.
What's the best bottle of wine you've ever had?
I don't know. I know the best medium bottle of wine that you can buy off the shelf, but I don't know about the best bottle of wine I've ever had.
Go with that. We want to hear that.
Have you ever been to somebody's house or a party or something and they brought a really nice bottle? Do you know? Do you know if you have?
I'm sure that I have. I just don't remember what the label said.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how interested in wine are you?
I'd say 6.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's your favorite grape?
No, okay, we're now past my ability.
Three.
Do you know the answer to these questions, David? Like, could you answer these questions for yourself?
Hey, David.
Yeah, I can answer
them for myself. What's the best bottle of wine you've ever had?
Well, the best bottle of wine I've ever had is the same bottle of wine that Jake Barnes. Yeah,
oh, you're kidding.
That Jake Barnes drank in this section, which is why I asked the question. Because there's this moment where Jake Barnes famously goes off by himself as the everyone's left him and he's in what, San Sebastian?
Mm-hmm.
No,
yeah.
San Sebastian.
Yeah.
And he's by himself and he says how great a companion a good bottle of wine is. And he's drinking a Chateau Margaux. Now, I don't know what year of Chateau Margaux Jake Barnes was drinking in 1920, but it was probably pretty good. Nowadays, Chateau Margaux is like extremely collectible. Heidi, what's the best bottle of wine? Like, what would you say is the best bottle you've ever had?
So I think my favorite bottle of wine.
You've been to France, so maybe this isn't fair.
We've had some good wine. I like wine a little bit.
Scale of 1 to 10.
I definitely the Chateau Margaux that we had with you and Bethany was just stellar. Like probably my favorite. But I've also had, when we did our Bordeaux trip, we had a Petrus, which is the rarest wine in the world. And that was
it's locked like a $3,200 bottle.
It was magnificent.
Like by law, it has to be, yeah.
I mean, I wasn't going to say that on the air because that...
I know, I said it for you.
Yeah. But we did have a bottle of that with dinner on our anniversary trip and it was magnificent. But I think prefer...
Even Heidi doesn't drink that every day.
It's just Tuesday. So maybe tomorrow.
Right.
That was probably the best bottle objectively that I've ever had. But my favorite, I think, was the Chateau Margaux. But I do prefer Saint-Emilion. And I could start talking... I'm done talking about the wine I like because that's going to dominate another podcast. We'll do that in another podcast.
There you go. I think we got to talk wine for a couple minutes on a podcast about The Sun Also Rises because it's a book that takes wine seriously. So I was thinking about this question though, and I think it's an interesting entryway into the end of the book. I've got all kinds of questions about how this book is structured, how it ends, questions of denouement and all kinds of questions like that. The kind of things we normally talk about. But do you think... Ooh, I got to turn the volume down on my computer so that Slack doesn't ding at you guys the whole time we're talking. Okay, so when you're... the way this book treats food and wine and partying and those sorts of things, in a way, it takes it very seriously.
Yeah.
And the characters take it very seriously. And then on the other hand, I can't figure out if it actually maybe takes it a little bit lightly. And so I was trying to figure that out. Is this does Jake Barnes himself take wine? Does he take it seriously, or do you think he takes it, I guess, lightly? That's the only phrase I can think of. Tim, I'd love to go back to you on this one, because he clearly he talks about wine as this great companion, right? He's very contemplative about these experiences that he's having, and he talks about beauty, and he talks about he talks about beverages and food like their nature or human beings or something like that. And yet, in a way, all these people are kind of abusing these beverages and the food that they're talking about, because they're a little down, right?
Yeah.
So I've been thinking, I don't know why this question kind of consumed my reading of these last few chapters, but maybe you can help me sort this out, because I don't have an answer.
I think he doesn't take them very seriously, if I understand what you mean. Like, is he a connoisseur? Is he devoting his attention to wine the way that he devoted his attention to the bulls and the bullfighters and the bullfighting ring? I think the answer is no. I think he drinks to get drunk. And so it might sound a little bit contradictory that he's drinking this really nice wine, but I wonder if it's just kind of he's feeling the party's over, Brett's with a bullfighter, I've lost. Hey, let's just spend money at random, because what do we got to lose? Mm-hmm. It tastes a little bit better, but I don't think he appreciates it like the way a connoisseur appreciates it.
So he's not an aficionado. He views himself as an aficionado about wine as he does about bullfighting.
Right.
Heidi, what about you? How do you read his appreciation for this particular variety of the finer things?
I'm a strong disagree with Tim on this one.
Oh.
I think that you said something important, Tim, in your answer to David, which is that he's paying attention to food and to wine. And I do think that he loves it very much. It was Hemingway's description of food and wine that started me on my own particular journey of paying attention to food, because I just wasn't raised like that at all.
Did it move the? Was it a movable feast?
A movable feast. Yes, it
Did
was.
Did that impact that?
Yes, hugely. That the idea of travel and enjoying and just paying attention, like lingering over a meal and describing it with words, like the connection between description and the experience, the sensory experience itself, was like very compelling to me in reading Hemingway. And I wanted to practice that. I would go home and write down what I ate and how I felt. And like, I was playing with words. Writer. Yeah. Well, the descriptive adjectives he uses to describe the experience of enjoying a meal and drinking a good bottle of wine, or that even like the temperature that always stuck with me, like the cold, how cold the wine was and how it beat it on the bottle, and the tang or the feel of the oysters on his tongue. There's a description of him eating oysters and drinking white wine in A Movable Feast that I can remember. That was the one. And I'd never had oysters, and I'd never had white wine at the time that I had read it. And I was like, he pays attention. Now, I do agree with Tim that he's not an aficionado in like the way a chef would be, or a food writer or a critic. He doesn't seem to know that much about food or the ingredients or how it's prepared. So that's not aficionado level, but the idea...
He's not talking about like terroir.
Yes, exactly. He's not talking about terroir. But he is paying attention, and it does give him pleasure. And it's like a simple pleasure like a child would have that he's not ashamed of, that seems to be a healing force in his life and a centering force in his life. And I find that compelling and true about food.
Hmm. So... There's this idea of the centering force, and then there's also this idea that it's clear that this whole group of people
are
is
gluttons.
Sort of there's gluttony. I think that's a word. Mm-hmm. There's like a, I think what we now might call self-medicating, or medicating with booze and food and pleasure and things like that. There's a sort of unhealthy. That they're unhealthy. they're down, they're sad, right? And so they turn to these things to forget the things they've experienced or the things they have to go back to. So is Hemingway, is the book itself suggesting, making any commentary on their approach? Like, he is presenting their actions in a very specific way. And I think that what a lot of people have trouble with is that any kind of commentary that Hemingway makes about this sort of lifestyle is perhaps not direct enough, right? Like, the book doesn't necessarily come right out and condone it. Terrible things, you know, they don't necessarily bear the repercussions of their behavior in ways that are obvious. And so at the end of the book, you're kind of like, well, wait, what was the point of all this? They went away, they partied, they watched the Bulls, they watched a guy die in the streets, Brett went off with a guy and then ended up sad. And so at the end of it, we're left with people who they're not much different than they were at the beginning, which can be a little bit of a dissonance as a reader. So then what commentary do you think the book is offering, Heidi, on the lifestyle and on these things that they are self-medicating with,
right,
but that Hemingway himself seems to see and to find great beauty in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's such a good question. There is a contrast between the way that Jake, particularly, I mean, all of them get drunk and overdrink and overeat and overindulge, and many of the pleasures of the flesh that are given to us as gifts. And I think there's such a contrast between the way that they eat and drink when they're at the fiesta versus the way Jake and Bill and his male friends eat and drink when they're out in nature on their own without the presence of Brett and the disordering force in the book. And they all love her, and yet she creates this profound disorder in each of them individually and amongst them in the relationships between them. And I think that for Hemingway, it's less of a comment on Brett, who he seems to have profound empathy for, the same way that readers who are paying attention probably should. She's not the bad guy. She's not the villain. But there is this sense of this disordered masculinity is further disordered by the presence of a strong woman, and then out. But when they're out in nature, that's when the descriptions kick in of like the simplicity of, you know, fishing and eating the fish that you caught with a wine that was chilled in the river. Or how he goes out swimming by himself when he's in San Sebastian, and then he comes back and he drinks the Chateau Margaux and has a good meal and talks about the simplicity of being in France, and all you have to do is spend money to make friends, right? And so there's a contrast.
When they're by themselves, when they're away from Brett, it's more contemplative, more poetic, more consumed with aesthetics.
More simple, yes, and exactly. And that there's and that they enjoy things more keenly through their senses, which the book isn't saying. I don't think that Hemingway is saying that that's the only way to enjoy things, but the book is contemplating what it's like to live under the sun, a life lived without the things of the spirit. And in which case, the simplicity of going swimming in nature and letting the water dry on your skin and enjoying a good wine and having a good meal and quietness surrounded by happy people, which is how he describes the people around him in San Sebastian, that's the best you can do. And so it's worthy to pay attention to. Whereas when they're in the contrast of them at the fiesta in Pamplona it's getting more and more disordered. They're enjoying their food and their drink less and less the more they partake of it. And so the food and drink is a focus of conversation and of attention while they're at the fiesta, but it gets disordered along with everything else.
Tim, it looked like you were going to say something, or you were deep in thought.
I think I read these last chapters differently. The way that I read them is that when the fiesta ends and when Brett leaves with the bullfighter and everyone heads their separate ways, we see Jake, yes, like kind of return to like this simple life. But I think it's because he's crash landing. I think all of the energy in his life associated with Brett, associated with finding like the temporary fix of this party, even the antagonism with Robert Cohn, which is a mild form of enjoyment because it's an amusement. It's now all gone. And it feels to me like this part of the book just feels so profoundly sad. And I don't get any satisfaction by a return to simplicity like I experienced when I read, when we were on the river with Bill. It just feels to me like, man, this is
it feels sad to you, his interlude in San Sebastian?
Yeah.
Do you think he's
profoundly sad?
Do you think he's recovering? Is it a healing place for him, or is he just wallowing? How do you, like, what happens to him there then?
That's a good question. I mean, I think he's recovering in that he's like, he should be letting the alcohol drain from his body, you know? and I think he's not been sleeping. So I think in that way, he's probably recovering, but I think he's just, yeah, I think it's more wallowing. I associate wallowing with self-pity, and I don't know that there's a lot of self-pity here in Jake. He seems to really pride himself in continuing to move forward, even when things are not as he wishes them to be. But I think it's a depressive state that he might be doing some enjoyable things, swimming, eating good food, drinking good wine, but I think all of the pleasure of them has kind of, it's promiseless.
You know, it's interesting because for me, the section is about contrast and like absence, both positively and negatively. Because the line, the section that the Chateau Margaux, I think I'd like to read the paragraph. It's on 236 in the Scribner book, the orange one. It's chapter 19, and he's in a cafe. And it says, "I went in and ate dinner. It was a big meal for France, but it seemed very carefully apportioned after Spain. I drank a bottle of wine for company. It was a Chateau Margaux. It was pleasant to be drinking slowly and to be tasting the wine and to be drinking alone. A bottle of wine was good company. Afterward, I had coffee. The waiter recommended a Basque liquor called Izara. He brought in the bottle and poured a liqueur glass full. He said Izara was made of the flowers of the Pyrenees, the veritable flowers of the Pyrenees. It looked like hair oil and smelled like Italian Strega. I told him to take the flowers of the Pyrenees away and bring me a view mark. I don't actually know how to say that, but the mark was good. I had a second mark after the coffee." And like that paragraph, there's so much of absence in that paragraph. And even he's been with all these people for all these weeks. And then he says a bottle of wine was good company. And that seems to be, you know, him sitting there thinking, well, this is better than what I was experiencing previously. And so on the one hand, there's like a tranquility about it. He's sitting there and he's drinking slowly and he's tasting the wine. Like I can imagine him, you know, when he talks about tasting the wine, this is a classic example to me of like a Hemingway or a Cormac McCarthy underwriting, because it gives you a chance to sort of put yourself there. Because when you're tasting the wine, he doesn't say that he was swirling it in the glass or that he was tasting it. And he doesn't talk about tannins and he doesn't talk about all the things you might talk about with wine, but you can imagine him doing that. Like I think when it says he's tasting the wine, I think there's a sort of purposefulness in what he seems to be doing, because he's talking about the whole approach to the whole meal and he's very careful about it. And then he drinks coffee and then he has the liqueur. And so there's a process to eating a really good meal, especially in France, right? Like they take it very seriously and he's being directed in that by the cafe itself. And he talks about the bottle of wine was good company. And on the one hand, that seems like a very like poetic thing, right? Like there's a sort of depth to a bottle of wine as good as a Chateau Margaux, which is maybe the most famous chateau in the world. And there's a depth to that, which has a sort of there's a sort of personality to a bottle of wine that's that good, that, you know, that's carefully created. And yet at the same time, there's a sadness to that that bucks up against that tranquility, because it's a reminder that the other people that he was with were not such good company. And it's a reminder that he's sharing the moment with a bottle of wine and not with Brett or not with Bill or not with anybody else. That's, you know, so it's both tranquil and extremely lonely bucking up against each other. And so for me, in a way, it's like one of the key scenes of the book, because those two things are bucking up against each other. And then that leads into the stuff in the end with Brett. And so then that gets me wondering about this, the flowers of the Pyrenees that he kind of rejects, that he doesn't like. And I was wondering how that plays into this whole scenario that Hemingway is creating here. Is that just him dropping,
comic relief?
Humor, like,
yeah.
Comic relief? Is it sort of like a dark Hemingway humor? Or is there something more to that in this moment?
I haven't read anything more to it in this moment. I've always just read that as like just a funny little comic relief moment, but I am willing to be convinced that there's some kind of symbolic depth.
It's not a leading question. I'm actually wondering, like, this seems like this big moment where he's finally by himself, and, you know, I think Hemingway drops in the Chateau Margaux for a reason, but then does he not drop the Pyrenees in for a reason other than to give us some sort of relief in this, like, kind of, like, to me, one of the things about Hemingway, Tim, you've talked about tension. And he's built up this tension through the whole book. And then he drops these moments of tension where there's so much tension in three lines. And then sometimes there's so much release of tension in three lines. And not a lot of writers can do that. And that's one of Hemingway's great gifts. And so I'm wondering if, like, he builds up the tension in those three lines about the Chateau Margaux. And then the Pyrenees stuff is about releasing that tension. Or is it continuing to build it up? Or am I just reading too much into it? Am I reading too, like, closely?
That's what we should call it. I'm just kidding.
I read it as he didn't like it, and so he got something else. I didn't read much into it.
That's fair.
I think it's a setup for the next paragraph. So for me, it's on 237.
Yep.
The waiter seemed a little offended about the flowers of the Pyrenees, so I overtipped him. That made him happy. It felt comfortable to be in a country where it was so simple to make people happy. You can never tell whether a Spanish waiter will thank you. Everything is on such a clear financial basis in France. It is the simplest country to live in. No one makes things complicated by becoming your friend for any obscure reason. If you want people to like you, you only have to spend a little money. I spent a little money, and the waiter liked me. He appreciated my valuable qualities. He would be glad to see me back. I would dine there again sometime, and he would be glad to see me. And would want me at his table. It would be a sincere liking, because it would have a sound basis. I was back in France.
Yeah, there's a transactional nature to the relationship.
And isn't this like the world that Jake is now inhabiting? I mean, this is like the public square, stripped free of anything but transaction. This is kind of the new world that's been happening, the new world that he flouted in Spain, that he corrupted when he introduced Brett to the bullfighter, that he can appreciate but can't really participate in, the world of ritual and complex relationships. These things are gone in Spain, and I think that he loves those things in Spain, and I think they are now kind of leaving for him, that he can't participate in those things anymore. He's actually kind of joined the forces of the corruptors.
So in France, this transactional, like the simplicity of transaction that can define relationships, that's the bad thing. But then the more complex relationships that he had in Spain is the good thing.
Yeah. And by complex, I don't mean strained. I just mean, Montoya. I mean, his relationship with Montoya is complex. Montoya is the owner of the hotel where he stays. They have ostensibly a financially transactionable relationship. But it's so much more complicated than that, because they also have a friendship. And it's also more complicated than that because Jacob introduces Brett to the bullfighter and Montoya harshly disapproves, because the rules have been broken. The rules of this more complex world in Spain have been broken. And so it's comforting for Jake to kind of return to this French landscape. But I read this a little bit with a sneer. I don't read Jake extolling the transactional nature of France as a good thing. It's just a simpler life, but...
Yeah, he says it's comfortable to be in that country.
Yeah, it's comfortable. But it's not, I don't think that Jake is saying, and this is the way that the world ought to be.
Right. Okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's comfortable, just, but that doesn't necessarily make it better.
Well, it's just soothing for him right now because everything's been so complicated and everything got so tangled up. And so it's like soothing for him to be on grounds that he can understand, right? And that's simple and that's clear cut.
And one thing I love about the way Hemingway does this is he makes him comfortable for a minute, but then you know it's not really going to last.
Of course.
Like, you know that Brett's, something's going to happen, and by the end of the book, he's not going to be sitting in France by himself with this easy transactional relationship, drinking Chateau Margaux every day, right? Like, you know, it's like another way of presenting tension or suggesting that everything's going to get turned upside down again.
Right.
So when...
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, go ahead. No, go.
I'm just really curious about both of, like, two very distinct reactions to this interlude, because I find this whole interlude extremely soothing and like healthy. And I've not always been the fine, upstanding citizen you see before you today. And so I know how this feels. But I'm also wondering if it's partly personality, like the idea of like being surrounded by complicated, messy relationships that are getting worse and worse. And then to like distance yourself from them and go be alone is like so, so attractive to me as an introverted kind of person. I love people, but I like need that. I spend a lot of time alone. And I think that I'm wondering if part of, I don't think this is lonely at all. I find this like very healing and necessary for Jake. But I also don't think that I also read this as a very circular type of novel. Like, this is a pattern in their lives. Like, this is going to happen next year when they go to the fiesta. This is like, they're going to, like, they go and they mess things up, smash each other up, as Fitzgerald said, another member of the Lost Generation. And then they go away and lick their wounds for a while. And then they come back together and party some more. And it's this just another circle around the sun.
I find this section to be, I don't know that I would say soothing, but I find it very human. Because there's the bit, for example, after he goes to eat and he goes to the hotel and he takes out his books, puts them on the shelf, and he organizes his clothes, and he takes his stuff down to the laundry, and he takes a shower, and he goes for a swim. And I read it as if he is trying to he's trying to create some order for himself. So as you've talked about a lot, there's been a lot of disorder in this book. And then even the transactional nature of that, he finds it soothing in the moment because there's a sort of logic to it, right? If I give you this, then you're going to feel this way about me. And he's making an attempt to generate order in his world. And I find that very human, because when things get chaotic, we try to create things. You know, whether it's we organize our desk, right? Things are chaotic, you clean your room. Whatever it is, like your work, some things are chaotic with your work. You're going to try to find little ways to create some order in your head and sort of in yourself. And so he seems to be pursuing that. But then in the midst of that, the telegraph arrives. Mm-hmm. Telegram. Are we in the age of telegrams or still in the age of telegraphs? Telegram. And so as you say, it's cyclical. Like, as he's trying to create order, just when he thinks he's maybe going to have a little bit of peace, all of a sudden Brett needs help again.
Right.
That's the difference. Like, I agree. There's a sort of recovery and recuperation period that we just read. But for me, looming over all of it is the specter of Lady Brett Ashley.
Right. Mm-hmm. Agreed.
She's this unspoken presence. I mean, like you're saying, David, she's like this absence. And the absence for me is so loud that, and I think part of the reason that it's additionally loud, more loud than when she was hanging out with the Count or when she was, you know, with Mike, is that I think there's a little bit of Jake that realizes she's actually with someone that he respects deeply. He respects the bullfighter. She may be with a better man now, because previously she would always come back to him.
Right.
Always come back to him. But now there's this possibility that,
right,
no, right, she's not going to come back to him.
Right.
That's, to me, that's the part of that just feels like there's a, amid the recuperation, there's this sadness that was, that's more palpable than was, than it was before the party started.
So in the end, she does call for him and then he goes to her. But what does it mean?
The call for Jake?
Either way, like at the end of the novel, where are they? I mean, like, what's the, you know, what's changed? Has anything changed?
I don't think anything's changed. No, it's another trip around the sun.
Yeah.
Are they more healthy? Is it less healthy? I mean, is there any hope?
Yeah, it really does feel like the same.
It's the same. It's like they're back in Paris and she's getting out of the car and saying, "Hey, you chaps," which, by the way, I really wanted to say, "Hey, you chaps," at the top of every show. And then we changed the intro. So now I can't say it. So but it would be awkward and throwing it in.
Would you like to just, we can reenact the old intro for a second here?
Hey, I'll just say no. Hey, you chaps. I don't think anything irrevocable has happened. I don't think anything's permanently broken that won't just be patched together like it always is. This is just another trip around the sun. The sun is rising again. It will set again. The same cycle of disorder and reordering. But
is there any hope?
Well, I mean, you have... I don't know if it's hope or if it's a thesis statement for the Lost Generation on page 248, the very famous, second most famous line probably, other than the last line of the novel. At the bottom of it, I'm going to say a bad word here, so cover your kids' ears if you don't want them to hear it. When Brett sends Romero away and she's shaking and Jake is comforting her, and she says at the bottom, "You know, it makes one feel rather good deciding not to be a bitch." Yes, it's sort of what we have instead of God. Like, that is that hope or is that despair? That's the brilliance of Hemingway, right? Like, is that a moment of hope? Is that a moment of moral purity or clarity for her? Or is that just another statement of enduring despair?
And I think it's important that this gets brought up here because we have this, we have had earlier these two contrasting scenes in the church, where Jake goes in and he's able to pray and he prays a little, you know, he doesn't even view his prayer as very good, right? And then, but at least he makes the attempt. He says at the time, "I'm not sure that I'm that religious, but then, you know, I try to be sometimes," or whatever he says. Brett goes into the church with him towards the end of the book and she can't pray. And then she's like, "I didn't realize you were religious. And he's like, oh, "I'm quite religious sometimes," or whatever he says. And then we get this line here, which, as you said, feels rather good deciding not to be. And then, yes, it's sort of what we have instead of God. And then he says, "Some people have God quite a lot." So let's can we contrast these two approaches to these two praying church scenes, and then based on what we have here with the end, because I feel like he's bringing those two scenes together with these three lines here.
Right. Agreed.
So I didn't really ask a question. I just said, can we do something? And
I think that the difference between the two of them inside the church is meant to be largely negated. Sure, Jake seems to have been raised Catholic and is in part a practicing Catholic. And Lady Brett was not, but I've read the kind of differences between them to be minimal. And I think that our author is trying to highlight that, Jake likes the color blue and Lady Brett doesn't like the color blue. And that's kind of the sum total difference in this book.
Like they live the same way, regardless of whether.
Exactly. Yeah,
they make the same choices, exactly. Which is what Cone and then later Lady Brett seem to be saying when they say, what's, or is it Brett or is it Jake? Who says, what's the use? Again, repeats that. What's the use? What's the use? Right. So in some sense, I think that's exactly what they're getting at is what you just said. It comes to the same thing in the end. It comes to just another circle, another cycle of, you know, aimlessness and despair. But underneath that, the question of hope, I think, is super important in Hemingway because he's not a nihilist. I mean, he's really not. He's looking, right, for some kind of, there is some kind of moral presence in his novels and in these relationships. There's some kind of moral standard that ties throughout his books and in this book that characters either rise or fall to. They grieve when they don't meet that standard, but they can't trace it anywhere. They can't seem to find it or locate it.
Yeah. David, what do you think?
Well, I was just going to say that I think that there's a misconception that because Hemingway subverts traditional fictional forms is evidence that he is a nihilist or that he also wants to subvert like cultural norms, which I actually don't think. I don't think that's true. Agreed. I think that like that's kind of like a bad reading. I think that's just like reaching for the
It's a shallow reading.
Shallow reading, yeah. But I read their differences to be much more profound. I think that their differences are why they can't be together. Like I think that in a sense they're
religious differences.
Like I think that their responses in the church are almost like objective correlatives for why they can't be together. I mean, at the end of the book, she says, "We could have had such a good time together," or whatever she says, and then he has the famous line, "Isn't it pretty to think so?" And I think that he recognizes in a way that she doesn't, or at least the novel is suggesting, and maybe is as much as I should say, that they have like sort of core worldviews, if you will, for just to use an oversimplified term, that keep them from being able to really connect. That they're grasping for different things because I don't think they can't not be together because of his wound. Like that's the, to me, that's like the, it's almost like a red herring. It's like, meant to distract you. I think that if she wanted, I mean, they couldn't be together in certain ways, but they could have been still committed to one another and they could have had like a relationship. They could have had a healthy friendship, all those sorts of things, whatever, however you want to take it exactly. But the thing that keeps them apart is that they have essentially different views of the world, I think. And I think that they fall into old traps for different reasons.
So when she, earlier in the book, David, when Lady Brett describes the Count, "He's one of us, Jake. He's one of us." I take that to be true. There's something that the three of them share, and I think it's something like a view of the world. And there's some differences there. I've never thought that the primary difference between Lady Brett and Jake is like that their codes are profoundly different. Because I actually think in some ways their codes are kind of, they're sort of a masculine and feminine archetypes that are kind of in some ways united. Like I think their codes are kind of similar.
I think that's fair. But I don't know that I'm necessarily talking about code. I think there's like more of a sensitivity question that's different, is maybe the way I want to put it. But go ahead, say what you're going to say.
I agree with you about that his injury is a red herring, but I think it's the red herring that Brett uses to sort of justify her not being able to be with Jake, because she can't be with anybody. Mm-hmm. I just don't think she can stay with anybody. And I think she probably loves Jake, and she also probably knows, like, I just couldn't stay. And so, gosh, if not for the injury.
I think you're right. So this is what I would say. She can't be with anybody because for the same reason that she doesn't have a sensitivity to the things that are happening in the church. Whereas he is able to be committed to her despite the way she treats him, because he does have a sensitivity to the things that are happening in the church. Like, I think that those things mirror each other. Like, I think that the same sensitivity that allows him to see what's happening in the church as meaningful is what allows him to be committed to her,
Brett,
despite everything that she puts him through.
And do you think that appreciation of what happens in the church, the fact that Jake can appreciate what happens in the church, and Brett seems not to be able to, do you think that overlays onto the bullfight?
How so?
Do you think that Jake can appreciate it?
I was not expecting that question to go that direction. That's interesting.
Oh, really? Do you think Jake can appreciate it and she can't?
Oh. Right, because Jake's a true aficionado, whereas she just isn't bothered by the blood and wants to sleep with the bullfighter. Yeah.
Jake can appreciate it in the way that this is really important, actually. Jake appreciates the bullfighting because he recognizes how terrible it is. Like, he appreciates the art of it, and he appreciates the whole situation. He's not bloodthirsty about it in the same way that someone might be able to appreciate what's going on in the church because they recognize how terrible what is happening up on the crucifix is. And I think in both cases,
like, it's momentous. The word terrible threw me off a little bit.
Oh, I think I was using the word. I think I was using that word because I think I thought you said it. Momentous, but also I think gruesome. I think he recognizes that there's a gruesomeness to what's going on down there, and he recognizes it for what it is. Like, he doesn't take lightly what's happening. Whereas in a way she takes it lightly, because she, as Heidi said, she just wants to sleep with the bullfighter. She does, the blood is sort of like, you know, immaterial to her. Whereas to him, it's almost like the whole point.
This is an interesting conversation for a lot of reasons. I think the wound question is interesting to me because it sparked a thought about Lady Brett and her relationship with Romero. What he wants, one thing we haven't talked too much about on the show, because there's so much to talk about in this short book, is Lady Brett's name and the fact that she has short hair and the fact that in a lot of ways she's more manly than any of the men, and that she's a bit androgynous, although she's deeply desired by all the men as a woman. And that's interesting.
Well, there have been many essays written on flapper culture from this perspective.
Absolutely. It's true. So. It's a huge part of the book. And she's completely unique amongst Hemingway heroines for the very reasons that I'm saying. And, but that, at the end of the novel, Romero wants, she rejects him, and she thinks it's for moral reasons, which it very well might have been. She's going to destroy his career. It's bad for him to be with her. He should go back and be a bullfighter. And she's traumatized by that, but she's also pretty self-congratulatory. And it's the one action she takes in the book that's actually for the sake of another and feels good to not be that line. But at the same time, it seems pretty clear from her conversation with Jake that one of the reasons that she sends Romero away is because he wants her to have his babies. He wants her to be more womanly. He wants her to grow her mm-hmm. hair out. And he mm-hmm. wants her to marry her. And he wants to bring her into his culture. And we've already talked about how he in the novel represents kind of this old world grandeur and a connection to the past. And she's, you know, nothing if not a severely modern woman for the time. And that's interesting that you say that Jake's wound is a red herring, because at the end, they are similarly wounded. He's been inflicted by the war, and she's in many ways inflicted herself with this wound of infertility, right? Like, she won't be a mother. She's not going to ruin her kids.
Right.
And she could be self-congratulatory about that, or she could heal and get better and become a better person and become a mother. Right. And so there is this sense in which Brett wounds herself and has a different kind of, there's a different kind of moral weight to the disorder that she brings within her society versus the men who are wounded. They receive a wound, she inflicts wounds. And so I think that goes somewhat along with what you're saying, which isn't to say that she's not wounded herself, mm-hmm. but she's the one between the two of them, and I'd probably argue within the whole group, that could make different. She could be different. And I think that's highlighted in this final scene.
Yeah, I mean, her line, "We could have had a good time together." Uh-huh. Suggests that. But of course, that's a, well, Hemingway is so great because each of the, that line and then his phrase, "Isn't it pretty to think so?" are, there's so many ways to talk about those two lines. Oh, and, you know, it's like there's such short, punchy lines that are so full of so many possibilities, which is why they're remembered, I guess.
I don't think Brett loves Jake. I don't
really.
No, I think Jake loves Brett, but yeah. I think that I also think he is somebody who dances around her and holds her up as an image. I don't think she loves anybody. Mm. And I think that's mm-hmm. her great tragedy. Like, it's like the saddest thing to not love anybody in an enduring way, to send everybody away who loves you. To like use them and cast them aside and never do them any good and just hurt them your whole life. It's like the saddest fate I can think of for a woman.
But that's okay. Yeah. But this is why this goes along with what I'm saying about the church stuff. Mm-hmm. To me, agreed. These are the two crucial scenes in the book, because he, like, it is so meaningful that he has a sensitivity and he makes an attempt to be present in that church. He makes an attempt to participate in it. And she is sensitive to it in a way that it, like, she runs from it. She begins to shake and like rejects it out of hand, and she can't participate in it. And like what she's doing is she is rejecting, she's rejecting the possibility of being whole and doing that. And he at least recognizes that in the church is a means of healing, and he, in a sort of weak way, attempts to participate in that. And he at least isn't rejecting it yet. Now, theoretically, maybe that could happen later, of course. Like he could go around the sun enough times and reject it.
Sure.
But he hasn't yet. Which actually, okay, this is going to be a weird transition. This is going to be a weird transition. This brings me to the question of bullfighting. Mm-hmm. Why bullfighting? Is it just that Hemingway saw bullfights? Because when he's writing this novel about the lost generation, he could have used any number of experiences that he had, right? I mean, he was in World War I, he had all kinds of crazy experiences, even when he was in his mid-20s. So what is how does bullfighting itself play into this as a sort of, into this novel as a theme, and why bullfighting? I feel like we have to at least address this question before we finish the book. Tim, what do you think about this? You've been to a bullfight. What did bullfighting represent in your life?
Heidi, what was the Picasso quote? I think that you cited it. Maybe it was David. It's something like, to an Englishman, a bullfight is butchery. To a Spaniard, it's religion, or something like that.
Sounds right.
Am I, like,
I mean, it wasn't that's me, but I like that quote.
I kind of think that's what's going on. And that's, I think, part of the reason why I appreciate your reading of the church scene. David, and Hemingway put that in there for a reason. But I almost read the church scenes as juxtapositions to the bullfights. The church is a place of ritual and deep meaning, in which a sacrifice is enacted. A bullfight is a place of ritual and deep meaning where sacrifices are enacted. And I think that neither Jake nor Brett can find what they're seeking in the church. I think Jake finds it in the bullfight. I think it is the enactment of a brave man in front of everyone risking his life over and over to accomplish a feat that he can only accomplish by courage and great risk. And I think the great hero of the book is Romero. I mean, I think that for me, one of the key kind of peaks in the mountains of this book is the fact that Romero got up over and over and over when Robert Cohn was hitting him. Robert Cohn knocks out everybody else, but Romero has something in him that Jake admires really, really deeply. And I think that we see it enacted in the bullfight. So
that's because Jake's the bull.
Jake's the bull. Like he's being passed by Lady Brett.
Or he wants to be the bull.
It's such a good... I was thinking about this exact question, like I said a couple times, it's not a straightforward allegory. They all kind of shift in and out of the different roles within the bullfight. And David, you said last week that you wanted to talk about fight, or that you were thinking as we headed into this, the fighting.
The boxing thing?
Yeah. Yeah. Who's going to punch who? Because who is going to punch whom?
It was always going to be Robert Cohn punching someone.
Right. Well, and I think he punched
the right
people.
One thing we know about Robert, yeah. He's going to punch people.
Yeah. I'm so much more sympathetic to Cohn this reading than I've ever been. But I think he punched exactly the right people. But that question of who is the bull and very, very, very much related to, you said, why bullfighting? And I think a lot of it is because bullfighting it does have this pageantry to it. It does have this, you know, this weight of tradition and beauty and grace and all that stuff, but it is inherently destructive to every single participant. Bull, matador, right. Steer, everybody in the ring is at risk, and everybody is going to be defeated by the thing that they're participating in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and Romero's ability to control the bull is why Brett is impressed with him in part. Like, it's not just because he's this beautiful young guy, which helps, but that's, I think, part of the whole thing. Like, you know, in literature, bulls are like this, are a huge archetype throughout literature. Right. I mean, they in some traditions, the bulls are like gods, right? Or mm-hmm. gods come down to earth as bulls. Right. They're like, you know, they were like kings practically the way they were viewed. But they also represent this like masculinity. In some cultures,
virility.
Represented virility. Yes. Yes. And so Romero is, you know, like he's like more power than he's able to control the godlike, virile, fertile, you know, creature that, you know, throughout all of literature has represented, or throughout many literary traditions has represented the height of masculinity, if you will.
Well, and his description able to dominate is very seductive. Like the description of how he takes down the bull is like, you could just substitute woman, and it's a very seductive scene.
He's like the uber.
Yeah.
Bull.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Interrupted you, David.
No, it's fine. And so I think it's just me. Like she sees that about him mm-hmm. and it's like runs so counter to
the men in her life.
Jake's. Yeah. And Jake's status, Jake's, you know, characteristics. I mean, he is not fertile. He's not, you know, he doesn't have the capacity to be the uber masculine, you know, to dominate the masculine ring there, right? Like in a ring full of masculinity, Romero dominates all of them. And that's what she likes about him. And it's what he recognizes he can't have. But I also wonder if there is something to, like, you guys talk about the pageantry thing, the ritual, the traditions, and you mentioned that it runs in comparison to the church stuff, Tim. What did you mean by that exactly? Because I think there is something to the contrast between the rituals of bullfighting and the rituals of the Catholic Church in you know, that they go to visit. And I think I think Jake values them both for that ritual, for that tradition. I think he sees this. I don't know that he would say that they're similar, but I think that the fact that he has a sensitivity to those traditions in both cases, or the fact that he has an interest in both, is due to a sensitivity to those rituals and traditions. And I think that they're like the common threads there is what he recognizes in both of them. So I'd love to know what you meant by that comment about the contrast between the rituals of the church and the rituals of the bullfighting.
Part of this, I think part of my answer is informed by things outside the book, but I think also from the book, the things that I think what I read inside the book is that when Jake talks, he talks not about what the Pope has done or anything associated with the Catholic Church. He talks about bullfights. That's what he's interested in. And he likes to explain it to Brett. He likes to talk about it with Montoya. He likes to talk about it with Bill and Cone. So I think his imagination is captured by the bullfights. And I think, and again, a lot of this is like stuff outside of the text, so take it for what it's worth. Hemingway is not a terribly religious figure.
I disagree with that. That's maybe part of
it. Really?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's extremely Catholic. Extremely.
Okay, go ahead.
But not necessarily in a, like, I think he was a troubled Catholic.
So, like, but do you think he's attempting to write a Catholic novel the same way that Graham Greene was, or Evelyn Waugh?
Graham Greene was a neurotic Catholic who had no choice but to write about what was going on in his soul.
Right.
So I don't think it was the same way.
How would you compare Hemingway with what we might think of as the 20th century Catholic novelists?
I don't think that he was trying to write a novel that's Catholic. I think that he was so, latent Catholicism that went waxed and waned throughout his life was so embedded in his psyche that it couldn't help come out in his work. So I don't think that he's trying to write a Catholic novel the way Graham Greene or Waugh or whoever were trying to write Catholic novels, where they're actively trying to write Catholic novels. I just think that he couldn't rid himself of Catholicism. And I think that was something, like, sometimes he raved against it and sometimes he accepted it and bought into it. And I think that I think it troubled him, and I think it gave him hope at the same time. I think someone needs to write. I would love to read a book about the relationship of his Catholicism with his notion of masculinity, because I think that there's some pretty complex interweaving ideas there, in terms of how he thought about God and priests and all that kind of stuff. There's a book or an essay written recently about his Catholicism. I'll have to find the link. Yeah, there was in The Guardian. There was something in The Guardian too, but I think there's a book either coming out or that came out recently. There's also a book about how he actually was a secret spy, and which I want to read.
So many
That's
books.
A side note, though.
David, I think I could get with your... I think the latent Catholicism, I think I can get with that. And I could even, like, make a case, presuming that that's true, that he's this latent Catholic and it's kind of like left a vacuum in him, that his affection for bullfights in some way is a surrogate for that. That makes complete sense to me. and perhaps he is wrestling with it. I just don't see his wrestling with the Catholic Church as a dominant motif in the book. I see it as a lesser motif in the book. And I think the major motif would be the bullfighting and what it means. Yeah, I think the bullfight provides the dominant motif rather than
church.
His visits to the church.
The church keeps coming up, though, and I agree with you on this, Tim. And I do think that he's I think we can trace differences in all the characters in their psyches. They're fully human characters, and you can trace these. You know, Lady Brett's very different than Mike, very different from Jake, and the way that they approach life and truth. But I would still argue, and I'm willing to be convinced otherwise, that one of the conclusions that the novel itself comes to is that it isn't any use, those differences. You just still end up hungover, drunk, going like around the same tree with these dysfunctional relationships. No matter what you believe, no matter where you go, no matter where you travel, no matter who you know, it isn't any damn use. And I think that's one of the conclusions of this particular novel, and one of the griefs of this novel, is that there are these differences, and yet it all comes to the same thing in the end.
Okay. So I disagree completely.
Okay.
Like I actually think the opposite is what this book is trying to say. Because this book is like, it's a subversion of literary archetypes, because it's subverting traditional symbols and suggesting that the subversion of those symbols themselves is what leads to that sort of the crisis that these people are living in. Just as the world itself was in crisis. So like, you look at every symbol that's in this book, as we've been talking about, it's a contrast with some other use of that thing.
Right.
So, I mean, you've even got like the bulls, which I think he's being very purposeful about the notion of like the idea of gods coming down to earth. I think he's choosing this symbol very carefully. And like, you've got wine, you've got blood, you've got sacrifice, you've got ritual and tradition, right. You've got the church versus the bullfight. I think all these things are about like the wrong use of those things, and how when they're used wrongly, you run into that cycle. You have that cycle. But when they're used properly, like there's a rightly ordered way that these things ought to be used that is healthy and does lead to I think he's using wine, like the over drinking of wine, as a sort of like recognition of like runs in contrast to the use of wine as part of a church ritual. Mm-hmm. I think he's using like the idea of sacrifice with the bulls, like literally killing the creature that gods in throughout literature came down to earth as, like sacrifice, and thus sort of by proxy like killing a god creature.
Right.
I think he's using all of these to suggest that they're in this position because they have rejected the prior meaning of those symbols.
But you're arguing that Hemingway or the novel is indicting that, not agreeing with it. Like what you're saying is that Hemingway has written this to reveal that then these characters have come to the wrong conclusion in rejecting these traditions, or distorting them diabolically.
But they made a conscientious choice.
Right. Well, the characters come to the conclusion. The characters end with, "Isn't it pretty to think so?" There is no, the characters, I don't think that they're nihilists, but the characters at the end have come to the conclusion that it isn't any use. And you're saying Hemingway and the novel hasn't come to that conclusion.
The second thing I definitely think is true.
Okay.
I don't think Hemingway is saying that there isn't any use. Do I think the characters? I think the characters don't come to conclusions. I don't think these are characters that come to conclusions. That might be part of what my problem is. Because I think that they go from one experience to the next in search of a conclusion. I think that's, I don't know that at the end of the book, like maybe in the moment they feel a certain way, but if it's everything cyclical, then they're going to have, the next experience is going to tell them some new conclusion to draw.
So who, oh, go
and
ahead.
You see Jake as an exception to that, David?
Good question.
Okay, so there's, think about it this way. There's like, I'm going to have to use hand signals here. For people, I'll try to explain my hand signals. There's a core in the middle, right?
Okay.
Like there's a order, like some sort of like, I'm making this up as I go along. There's like an energy core in the middle, right? And it's like the ordering structure of the universe. I'm going to use very general terms here. And then you've got these characters that are like going around in circles around that core. Uh-huh. But they never really make in contact with it. I think different characters are further out in their circles from that core. So like if there's a rightly ordered way of viewing the world and that's in the middle, then like Jake's a little closer in terms of how he's circling around that. I'm using circles because you guys were talking about the idea of you're just constantly
going
in circles.
What you're saying is really helpful for me.
So he's a little closer to that energy core in the middle, and then you've got Brett's maybe one circle out, and then Robert might be second, and then we could order all these characters. I think it like the rings of Saturn, right? And so I think he's closer to it, but I don't know that he's an exception to the rule that everyone else is.
Okay.
If that makes sense. I think he is more sensitive to what may... So I think they all recognize there's something wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And they're just in a lot of pain, so they recognize that. I think he is closer to understanding what it is that's causing them to be wrong and what to feel badly and what the solution to that might be. I don't know that he's... I'm not saying he's healthy. I think he recognizes what that solution would be more than...
Right.
Than Brett, for example.
Because he keeps returning to the church and attempting to participate in the church.
And I don't think that Hemingway is being cynical about that.
Right.
I don't think Hemingway is a cynic.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I completely agree. And I think he would say it's the... Yeah, I agree with you.
I think he was maybe a cynic about the establishment on Earth, like, you know, the business of the church or whatever, Hemingway the man. But I don't think he was a cynic about the church and the notion of faith per se, if that makes sense.
Do you think that do you think that Hemingway would say that where do you think the novel is placing the disconnect, the failure between the core and those revolving around it in that second circle that you're referencing? Where do you think the novel puts the blame for that? Or indicts or considers a failure.
What is it that keeps them from being closer to the circle?
Yes. In the world of the novel itself.
I'm trying to put it in a way that's like from the book instead of from a different book. I think there's a lot in common with this book and what's the book where we read earlier the line about connection?
Do you mean the song?
Oh yeah, Howard's End.
Howard's End. I think there's a lot of similarity between this and Howard's End, and I think that part of the problem, at least, is it's like a chicken and egg thing here, but the inability to connect.
Mm-hmm.
But also not being able to diagnose what it is keeping you from being able to.
Right, I was going
to
say that seems like a symptom
because,
to me, not the cause.
Right, I mean, like that's why his injury is like a red herring by the end of the book, because it's like almost like an excuse for why she can't be tight with him. You know, like she thinks she can't offer him anything because he's got this wound that makes him infertile. But like that's an excuse for her actually not actively trying to connect with him, because there's other kinds of connection too. So that might be what I would say. Ask the question
and
again.
They have.
Go ahead.
What's the failure? Go ahead.
They have an inability to connect with each other or toward this kind of deep, grounded, organizing way that the world ought to be?
Yes.
Both.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the, I think those two inabilities are connected to one another.
Yeah, I agree. I'm curious. I think Heidi asked the question earlier, and this is the one that I'm most curious about, is like, why not? I mean, or who is to blame, or what is to blame for that disconnect?
I mean, I think that it goes back to the bullfighting to some degree, because I think that there is a sense in which the bulls sort of, I mean, try not to read into this too much here, but I think there is a degree to which the bulls represent the lost generation being lured into the arena and danced with and then slaughtered.
Agreed.
I don't think that it, I actually don't think, I think that that's what Hemingway is saying it feels like, to be part of that generation, to, you know, and there's not a lot of a difference between what the bull is going through when it's lashing out in rage sometimes, like Robert Cohn, at the other creatures and the people in the ring. And sometimes the bulls just want to do nothing, right? They just want to stand there and everyone jeers at them for wanting to stand there. And that's sort of like Mike or something, you know, there's, so I think that is sort of representative of what it's like to live in the age, and that living in the age itself is cause. And so in that way, I don't know that it's so much so unlike what you might, C.S. Eliot might have written. Like, I think you could read The Wasteland and The Sun Also Rises as an interesting double feature.
Of course.
Because I think that they're getting at similar things, and I don't think that their conclusions about what is causing it and what the solutions are that far apart.
But okay, so here's where I would differ, or maybe just ask the question. I think that the Catholic novelists, who we would traditionally think of as the Catholic novelists,
yeah, I'm not saying that's Hemingway,
are advocating for a return, and I don't hear that in Hemingway ever.
But Hemingway's not an advocate. Hemingway's just a
right. He's a storyteller.
Hemingway's a journalist. He would say that what he's giving us, I think that he would say what he's giving here is facts. He's telling us what the age is like.
Yes.
He's not saying that the age is like this and thus we need to return to this. Mm-hmm. Whereas Graham Greene is like, in a way, he's an evangelist.
Yes.
I mean, I'm using the term very loosely. He's saying, you know, there is something to return to. And I think that Hemingway, while hopeful, is maybe a little more cynical because I mean, he said he wasn't cynical about the church, but I think that maybe he is more cynical about, he maybe is a little less like specific in the ways that solutions can be offered. But I just don't think his goal is set out. I don't think he sets out to do this, to do what those Catholic novelists were going to do. But I think that there's a sense in which he believes what they, he clings to what they say. We could get into some Hemingway life stuff here if we wanted to, but that's a different conversation. I mean, maybe it's not. I don't know.
Maybe.
I also don't know that this is 26-year-old Hemingway, and I think he waxed and waned in his hopefulness and in his sense of what orders things.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, then, 10 being most hopeful,
and I'm an 8 on the wine scale.
Hopeful at all. Where would you put this novel?
10's hopeful?
Yeah.
And 1's, so what's, give me an example of a 10.
1 is like despairing.
No, but like, give me an example of a book that you would consider a 1.
What about Les Miserables as a very hopeful?
I've never read Les Mis, but.
Do you know the story though?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. What about The Odyssey?
Is that a hopeful story?
Yeah. Like, do you, I guess I'm, I mean, we can talk about scaling it, you know, if you want to. I guess I'm just, trying to gauge how, like, I don't think this novel's hopeful at all, but I don't think that means he's a nihilist. Like despair and nihilism are two different things. And even though Christians conflate them,
I just don't think Hemingway would think about it this way. That's the trouble for me. Like, I don't think that he is saying, I think he's giving us what he views, he's giving us facts through poetry. Like, that's what he thinks he's doing. So I don't think that he's looking at it. And I don't think by the end of the book that he's trying to say, the world is like this and thus there's no hope. Then he's a cynic, and or the world is like this and here's the solution and thus it is hopeful because these characters are moving towards that solution. I just don't think he was trying to do that. So it's hard for me to answer that question for that reason, because I don't...
You deny the premise.
I think that whether this book is hopeful or despairing says more about you than it does the book, which I don't mean as an accusation.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. I don't know that I agree, but I get what you're saying. You're saying he's just telling a story about these people.
I think he's saying the world is full of despair. Yeah.
Yes.
But it's also full of good things. Like honestly, okay, I view this the way this book thinks about the people as a four on the cynical scale, and the way this book has hope for what the world can offer to people like that as like an 8 on the hopeful
That's
scale.
Interesting. I get it. I get the dissonance then that you're describing. Yep. I understand.
That's 8's helpful. Pretty high. 7? 7? I don't want to make, like, I don't want to ruin Hemingway's reputation. So let's go at the 7.
Happy, jolly, sunny Papa Hemingway.
But like embedded in this book is a sense of beauty.
Agreed.
And a sense for things that are beauty.
Yes.
And the despair of this book is that the characters don't know what that means. They don't know how to use it. They destroy it. They subvert it. They flip all that upside down. They disorder all that. But there is a sense that the world has beautiful things to offer in it. And so in that way, I think that's what makes the book so complicated and makes it like the experience of reading it.
I wholeheartedly agree with everything you just said. I think that's 100% true.
And like, I think there's this weird balance between like Epicureanism and Stoicism in Hemingway that is, it's like weirdly un-American and like difficult to process. And that's what makes it worth going back to his books. Like that balance between those things, like they're like two things running up against each other again. And sometimes Hemingway seems to feel like the way forward is to be an Epicurean. And sometimes he feels like the way forward is to be a Stoic, and that he's constantly trying to find that ordering balance between those two things, which some people would say is asceticism, but you know, that's a different story. Anyway.
No, that's helpful.
We just spent the last like 30 minutes getting into
I think you're getting into the heart of the book though. Like that's what we're talking about. It's interesting that pretty much up until this final episode, which I'm really sad that it's the final other than the Q&A, but up until then, all of us have been like, yes, whatever you said, I completely agree with. And then you get to the end and you've like, we as readers have come to different conclusions that we hold to be very core to what this novel is. And I find that compelling and speaks to Hemingway as the brilliant novelist that we've been claiming he is.
Yeah, but it means either I am really smart because I disagree with the two of you, or I'm really dumb because I disagree with the two of you. So,
well, I think it speaks to the complexity of the novel and the and what.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's what you're saying.
Yes, okay, like what it brings up, and as you said, and I completely agree with you, that so much of our responses to a novel say way more about us as readers than they do about the objective thing that the novel means or says or is. And I think that's one of Hemingway's probably every great novelist, but Hemingway in particular, there's a way to read Graham Greene wrong, right? If you get to the end, to your point about him being an evangelist, if you get to the end of a Graham Greene novel and you like, there are certain things that you'd just be reading wrong if you got it out of the novel. And I don't know that that's true about Hemingway. There's just this complexity in this,
Yeah, well, there are Hemingway scholars out there that are just yelling at their phone right now.
So. Right, but they're the same, right? Their scholars don't know everything they think they know. Like, we come to conclusions about things, and they're fair, and if we can defend them, great. But a book, a novel is a mirror, and that, and you know, can anybody tell us what a mirror looks like? It looks like me, right? So that's... I think that that's such a good point, because a lot of what both of you have said, I'm like, initially, oh no, that's not it. But then as I listen, I'm like, that's really fair. That's true. It's just something I didn't see because I was too busy looking at my own face staring back at me from the novel. So that's helpful to talk about.
Yeah, and I guess I just got the last 30 minutes to defend my face. Yeah. So yeah. Tim, you the last couple minutes, you look like maybe you want to take issue with something, but then Heidi beat you to it, or you were just letting her argue with me. So you got to get a chance to, you know, get in here and we can throw some punches. Just in keeping with the theme.
The more I hear your position, the more it makes sense. I lean toward Heidi.
All I did was ask questions, by the way. So it was very Socratic.
I do think that the conclusion of this book is, I don't like the word ambiguous, but I can't think of a better one. It's ambiguous in a way that some of Hemingway's other books I don't think are ambiguous. For Whom the Bell Tolls, I think it's clear. He has a heroic character, and that hero kind of, you know, lives his life in the right manner. And I think the conclusion of the book is an advocacy for that kind of,
right,
that heroic stance. Whereas,
I mean, Hemingway is definitely into a code.
Yes.
Yeah, he had a code. But I think this early book, written as a young man, I think that code is still malleable. I don't think that he's really, so I agree with you, David. I think that he's, I think he's trying to assert a code, but I don't know that he has it really fully formed yet in his own mind. I don't think that he's just being a journalist. I think he's doing more than that. I think he's trying to assert something that is still kind of soft clay in his own mind.
And, well, facts say things, though. I mean, I'm not saying he's not trying to make a point with those facts per se. I guess I didn't mean to overstate that part of it. Go on. Okay. Sorry. That's
awesome. Yeah. So I think that's part of the reason why I do. I think the final chapters that we read for this podcast are like, what exactly is going on? I think it's a little bit more pliable and subject to interpretation, I think, than a lot of his other works are.
Do you guys read, you guys both love A Moveable Feast, right? Yes. Like, I think you said that.
Mm-hmm.
Heidi, do you read A Moveable Feast as hopeful?
No. It's grief. To me, it's like a treatise on grief, but it has some really funny parts to it. It's high and low.
So you're saying it's a Hemingway book.
It's a Hemingway book.
What about you, Tim?
I think that book is very episodic, and I think it's meant to be read episodic. It's kind of short stories, all kind of organized under his time in Paris. But I do think that the conclusion about his relationship to his first wife is full of grief. It's profoundly sad, but it's kind of funny that I don't read the whole book as leading toward that moment. I think of that moment as sort of like refracted light that kind of pools in a similar place, and it pools on the grief of what he did to his first wife.
Is a book being full of grief, or how did you put it, Heidi?
And I said exercising a
grief. On grief. Is the fact that a book is a treatise on grief necessarily
hopeless?
Mean that it's hopeless?
No. But I don't think Hemingway's work is full of hope. I think it wants to be.
That's a different question.
I know. But I think, well, that's true. And I'm asking a question I hear behind the question, which I might have interpreted wrong. But I think that Hemingway wants to feel hopeful. And I think he's casting around, but I don't know if I think his work finds it.
Well, I think that's fair because I think there's a, yeah, okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
But I also think, I want to say one thing I think that you're right about yeah. the journalist thing is that he's at a pivotal moment in history writing, having lived through kind of the before and after of World War I and what that did to the world. And he's reporting on that. I think that you're right about that. He's reporting on it. And I don't think he finds this in this. I'm comparing or contrasting him to Graham Greene and Flannery, all, you know, those Catholic writers that are advocating for a return. I find that Hemingway's just mourning that loss and reporting on how that feels. So I think that you're right about that. But yeah, so I think that's all.
Yeah, no, I don't actually disagree with that. I think that that's why I said there's a difference between something being hopeless and then, like, the opposite of hopeless is, I guess, hopeful. But there's a difference between a book being, like, there's somewhere in between where you say that what you're grieving is the fact that there used to be or is this possibility of hope in the world, but we can't access it.
Yeah.
And that's what I think Hemingway's books are about. Like, they're saying there is something to be hopeful in the universe. Like, and so many of the symbols in his books are striving or representing things in which it's worth hoping. Mm. But the fact that his characters so often can't grasp that hope, like it goes through their fingers, is what is worth grieving. That they can't reach out and grasp that hope is worth grieving. I think that's what his books are about. And I don't think that that is a hopeless notion. Mm-hmm. I think that that is a sad notion, but I don't think that he is saying that we're never going to be able to grasp these things. I don't think that I think that it is a hopeful notion to say that the universe is imbued with those things, in fact. I think that's one of the things that makes him, I think that's one of the reasons people go back to his work, because they recognize in it the sense that there is something worth grasping for in the world. And they recognize that we see ourselves so often as characters for whom that is slipping through our fingers. Mm. That was one of the things I think makes it lends a universality to his canon in general. And I think each of his books has those characteristics to varying degrees, as anybody's does, that writes as many things as he wrote.
David, your mic is getting, you're kind of falling away from the mic.
Testing.
Your sound is dimming because the mic's not pointed at you.
Hopefully that's better.
Yeah,
better.
We've been an hour and a half, mostly having takes awesome. That you guys are. Do you guys want to, what should we talk about here at the end before we go to the Q&A episode next week? Anything you want to add, Tim?
The word elegy kept coming up to me when I finished this book. It feels mournful, but an elegy is also kind of like a celebration of something that has passed. And I wonder if that's a way to think about this book, that it's not just asserting that the book is, that the new world, sorry, it's not asserting that the world is a hopeless, vacant place. Mm-hmm. I wonder if it's a mourning of something that has passed, that his characters feel like they can no longer retrieve. And to Heidi's point, I think that Graham Greene would say something like, yeah, we can retrieve it. It might look different, but we can retrieve it. Yeah. And we ought to retrieve it. And I think that Hemingway's maybe saying,
I can't.
I'm mourning its loss. I don't know how we're going to retrieve it. And I don't know that I'm not sure that he's asserting that we should try to retreat it. So I don't know. An elegy keeps coming to mind.
That's a good word. Good word in general.
Okay. I have a question that has bothered me this entire time reading this novel that I've never thought of before. So I know we're at the end of time. And so if we can't cover it and get everybody's thoughts, I get that. But what's the point of Bill?
That might be one to say for the Q&A episode, actually.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
That is a good Q&A question.
Somebody just put that in the comments thread on Facebook.
Yeah.
somebody ask Heidi's question, or Heidi, you can just ask the question. And we can say, so Heidi asks.
And you know what you're going to do? You're going to call on me first. I know it. And because it's Heidi a real asks, question. What's the point
of Bill? Hey, Heidi, what do you think?
It's a real question that I want to hear y'all's thoughts on. So that's my closing thought.
Well, that gives us a week to think about what the point of Bill was. well, thanks for humoring my
there's no humor.
My opposition takes.
No, it's like really thoughtful.
It was good, David.
Yeah. Now I have another take on Hemingway.
Now you can read the book again.
Yeah. Done.
With my theories in your brain. Maybe while drinking Chateau Margaux.
Yes. That is what I should do. I just have to talk to Scott about that investment.
Investment. I like that reframe, Heidi. That
it's investment. An investment.
If you bought a bottle of Chateau Margaux right now from like, say, 2010, say, in like 10 years, you'd make bank on that. So it probably would be a good investment.
We do have boxes.
Would be an investment. Something tells me that Heidi's less interested in investing in a bottle of Chateau
Margaux. I am interested Margaux in investing in my Imago Dei, which can be nourished by the first,
by the
sacramental the image friendship. Of, yes.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. All right, guys. Well, I guess we should wrap this up. Tim, thanks for your time. Heidi, same to you. Next week will be our Q&A episode. We will post the thread where you can post your questions on Facebook, and you can also email them to us at closereadspodcast@gmail.com. Our final Crime and Punishment episode for the Patreon bonus content is going up today or tomorrow. And then we're going to dive into The Lord of the Rings. So if you want to join us for those conversations, you can head over to patreon.com/closereads and sign up there. The first episode, we're going to cover chapter one, An Unexpected Party. The three of us will be there, and then we'll explain a little bit about how we're going to approach that trilogy, that trilogy of long books. We'll give you some insight into what that's going to look like. So that'll go up in a couple of weeks. Don't forget about the daily poem, the play's the thing. Heidi and Tim and Sarah Jane, you've been going through the Merchant of Venice, and you've recorded two acts.
We just finished act 2 of Merchant of Venice.
Act 1 is up, so you can go listen to that. Act 2 will go up later this week. So I guess what I'm trying to say is there's lots of content for you. And then finally, don't forget about the newsletter. If you head over to closereads.substack.com, you can get access to that. And in the next week or so, I will be sending out reading schedules for our next book, which is Marilyn Robinson's Home, as well as The Lord of the Rings and any other news that needs to get shared. So with that, I guess that's about covers it, unless Heidi or Tim, you want to pitch,
and
announce.
Furthermore, no, I'm just kidding.
Or otherwise talk about some other thing.
Nope.
You good? Okay.
Good.
All right. Well, for Heidi White and for Tim McIntosh, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, happy reading.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.